Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Professor Nikki Falkoff, who is a cultural studies scholar based in the Media Studies Department at the University of the Witwatersrand. Her current research interests center on race, anxiety, and moral panic in the urban global South, with a primary focus on South Africa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Prof. Falkoff, media is everywhere, be it print, radio, TV, out of home, social media. A report from Statistica indicated that as of 2024, the average daily social media usage of internet users worldwide amounted to 143 minutes per day. That's just social media. Media plays a significant role in shaping how individuals perceive themselves as well as others and construct their identities and navigate their social worlds. You hold an interdisciplinary PhD in humanities and cultural studies at the London Consortium, University of London, and you've also worked at the Media Studies Department for over a decade and served as head of the department. What triggered your interest in media and cultural studies?
It's a slightly odd story, to be honest. I was living in the UK, working as a journalist, trying to make a go of being a writer, really unsuccessfully. It wasn't, nothing was going anywhere. And at some point I decided I would go back and do a master's degree because, you know, I had loved studying and I thought it would be great. And I managed to get some funding, which at the time was a lot easier to do and was crucial as a South African in the UK because obviously the fees were extortionate even back then. So I went and I did a master's in critical theory. I still don't really understand what critical theory is. I chose it because it seemed like it was a challenge and it was too much of a challenge. So whereas the people on my course were doing things around Derrida, I found myself getting drawn into a completely different world of criticism and ended up writing a dissertation about race and masculinity in 1980s action films. So I have seen Predator 752 times. And I really, really enjoyed the experience. You know, I had to work on the side, but as I said, I had some funding and I got to have this wonderful moment of a year out of my life where all I had to do was think and write. And I realized that this was something that I really enjoyed and something I was potentially quite good at. So then when I was casting around for something to do after that, I thought to myself, well, I could do a PhD. I don't necessarily have to. It wouldn't mean I would have to move into academia. And I kind of talked myself into doing a doctorate round the back way without having any real ambitions towards having a career in it. Found a stunning program at the London Consortium, which no longer exists, which was a collaboration between the Tate Modern, the Science Museum, the Architectural Association, the ICA, and Birkbeck College. So it was this beautiful educational experiment. And I went and managed to get myself accepted to that program, managed to find again some money, which of course is much harder to do now than it was then. And I'd suggested that I was going to write a PhD about South African film. And then I started looking at the films I wanted to write on, realized that they were terrible, and I didn't want to spend 3 years of my life thinking about them. Had a meltdown in the office of the head of graduate studies and said, I don't want to do this topic. And he made it clear that they had agreed to fund me because they were interested in South Africa. So I had to think of something to write about that related to South Africa. And I racked my brains and I cried in the back room of the British Library and I drank enormous amounts of tea and I did not know what to do. I had my scholarly crisis right at the beginning of my scholarly career and eventually stumbled across this question that just animated my life for years. It's an odd question. Where did all the Satanists go? And this was a question based on my own experience of growing up as a white person in South Africa. In the 1980s, there had been an enormous moral panic around Satanists, particularly featuring white kids, young white kids who were suspected of being Satanists. This impacted on my life because I was an odd teenager and had been sort of caught up in the scare a little bit when people at my school had gone, oh, she must be a Satanist because she's wearing black all the time. So many, many years later, this question came back to plague me. I was like, wait, this was such a huge issue when I was an adolescent. Where did it go? And I found myself following that question down that metaphorical rabbit hole, which led me to a whole series of questions about what it meant to be white in South Africa at the end of apartheid, and what all those strange feelings that I half recalled meant, which then led me into a very, very kind of detailed study of archival media, because that was the only place where I could find the kinds of conversations that I was trying to excavate. What people were saying in newspapers, what people were saying in these really trashy, very popular so-called family magazines around the multiple anxieties of being white and facing the projected end of apartheid, which was also suggested to be the end of whiteness as we knew it. And that was what kicked off my PhD study. And that was what pretty much led me to the intellectual career path that I've been following ever since.
I have to say that was the least expected answer I was waiting for. What a niche area. That's incredible.
It is very niche. There was a point when my undergrad students were calling me hashtag Dr. Satan, which really was very entertaining, but yeah, didn't quite take.
And in terms of the now, your current areas of research, what are you looking at, and how do you feel that contributes to the field of cultural studies or media?
So I've largely moved away from talking about Satanism because there really is only so much that you can say. But the concerns that underpinned all of that work still fundamentally underpin everything I do, because as I have progressed in this career, I've realized that what I'm really interested in, and this manifests in multiple different ways, I'm interested in the way in which persistent negative emotions like anxiety and fear intersect with race, particularly in cities, particularly in the urban global south, where people from different racial groups, different cultural groups, different national groups, different backgrounds, all of these different intersectional features that make up our identities in the 21st century are all smushed together in quite small, quite conflicted and contested geographical spaces. And this makes people feel very, very uncomfortable and very anxious. So the work that I'm doing at the moment is concerned with the way in which emotions like anxiety structure social life in places like Johannesburg. I'm extremely interested in Joburg as a city, not only because I live here, but because it is such a very complicated and contradictory place that is, welcoming and creative, but also incredibly risky and very, very liminal. And at the moment feels slightly like it's falling apart as the infrastructure collapses around our ears. It almost feels as though Johannesburg is a kind of a laboratory for urban life. And this is what's going to start happening everywhere. Water shortages, power shortages, massive inequality, massive problems with violence, both gendered and general. These things are hyper visible in Joburg, but they are starting to affect cities everywhere. I guess part of the impulse that drives me is the desire to take emotional life seriously. Because there is a trend in which we just dismiss the way in which we feel as though it's not particularly important. It's not hard politics. It's not hard fact. The far right in America does this a lot. They like to go, facts don't care about your feelings. But feelings are fundamentally the things that make us act the way that we do.
Listening to you, it's almost as though there's a dissociation between what we're feeling, the lived experience, and then apart from individual identity, collective identity, there's also the identity of the environment. And in your case, your area is thinking about Johannesburg as sort of this living organism.
Yeah, I would say so. There are multiple layers on which emotion works because, of course, we do feel things individually, and that's important. And things happen to us individually in our lives that make us feel certain ways. But what's much more important politically is how we feel as collectives, whether these collectives are as women, as white people, as black people, as South Africans, as immigrants, whatever the defining feature is that we use to build ourselves into an imagined community, there are moments in which we feel things because other people in that community are feeling things too. This is how xenophobia works. This is how riots happen. This is how the insurrection happened. This is how mass outbreaks of violence happen, because emotion becomes collectivized and we as individuals become swept away. Away with the emotional conditions of those other people who belong, whether literally or on an imaginary level, to our communities. And yet, politics and a lot of mainstream scholarship is not interested in these things, are not interested in emotions. They dismiss them. They say that emotion is feminized. You know, women are too emotional, which is why they can't be in government. We hear this all the time, and that's despite the fact of, you know, the way that male politicians perform their violent emotions in public so shamelessly and so often. And we need to be able to think about the way in which what we feel impacts not just on what we do, but also how we vote and where we live and how we spend our money, because all of these things structure our cities. And you see it so clearly in a city like Johannesburg, where middle class people will go and spend their money inside the mall because it makes them feel safer. And that has massive knock-on effects on how traffic works, on how the city is developed, on the absolute appalling lack of public space. All of these things are related to how we feel.
You've given a lot of food for thought as we've been progressing with the conversation. And some of the aspects I feel are almost it's negative emotions that have negative outcomes, whether it's infrastructure, fear of personal safety and the way that we behave. Is there a way, and I don't know if this is a shift in some of the work that you do, of almost converting those negatives into positives so that we have a more beneficial society?
You're asking the wrong person. I am really negative and depressing work. My poor grad students leave my honors class with a sense of overwhelming doom. I mean, I think that there are ways to activate and manifest positive emotions so that they have positive outcomes. The research that I'm doing at the moment is shifted towards a broader examination of these questions in the global south. So I'm trying to move beyond just talking about Joburg and talking about other cities. So I spent 3 months last year on a fellowship at UNAM in Mexico City, which is an incredible place, but also dangerous and liminal and scary. But it was so interesting to be in Mexico as a South African and to see how effectively the Mexican government, notwithstanding all of their problems and notwithstanding the fact that everyone knows that these problems are real, the way that they managed to activate and manipulate much more positive feelings of patriotism and pride in the nation and pride in national history and love for one's country, all of these feelings that can be very bad and very dangerous and can lead to mass violence. But they utilize them in such a way that they, you know, there are huge public events of nation building frequently. For example, the annual celebration of Independence Day. And what these things do is they bring people together in a mass community onto the streets. There is music, there is life, there is a celebration of a shared culture. And while we can and must, of course, critique this shared culture, because the notion, the whole idea of a shared culture is to kick out a whole load of other people, what it does is it provides people with a sense of hope and a sense of optimism in the face of a potentially, for some of them, quite difficult way of life, living conditions that are, you know, really, really favor the middle classes. And their state is so good at doing that. And here in South Africa, our government has no idea how to parlay potentially positive feelings into a sense of community or a sense of civic well-being that can actually lead to people doing things that might make society slightly better.
And that speaks to your point on the collectivism of whatever associations you belong to, whether they're small or larger or different sub-communities of how that feeds. So I think that Mexican example is fantastic. Turning back to sort of the negative side of things and thinking about media, thinking about gender, I mean, one of the issues that we know in South Africa is that many women are victims of GBV. When I looked at the Q2 crime stats for 2023 to 2024, it showed that South Africa recorded, we know that obviously there are unrecorded figures, but in the recorded figures, there were 10,516 rapes, 1,514 cases of attempted murder, and 14,401 assaults against female victims. Look, these figures are appalling, and it does show the lived reality that many women in this country experience. I know that you edited a publication together with Shilpa Padka and Srila Roy, titled Intimacy and Injury in the Wake of Me Too in India and South Africa. And when I was briefly looking at the synopsis and some editorial coverage of it, it really struck me that in the global south, our experiences of Me Too are quite different to what was happening in the US. Can you share some of your insights about this collection of essays and potentially how women within the Global South can take action as individuals against GBV or as a collective?
Well, I mean, I must, in the interests of transparency and disclosure, I must acknowledge that this wasn't my project. It was Srila Roy's project, and I think she brought Shilpa on as a second editor, and I came on a little bit later. So I had no hand in designing it because this is not quite my area of research. But the process, the editorial process of being part of putting this book together was incredibly interesting for me because I realized quite quickly that what we were doing as editors and what most of our contributors were doing, and this is belied by the title of the book, which I think is a good title, but it's a title that's chosen because, it's going to get the necessary kind of attention. What the book is actually trying to do in many ways is to show that the Me Too movement did not impact in India and South Africa. And the reason that that is important is that the narrativization of the Me Too movement that came from the West was, don't worry, feminists in the global South, women in the global South, we're here now, we'll come and save you. And what so many of our contributors were trying to do is to show the power and the agency of these long-standing feminist movements in India and South Africa that predate Me Too by decades, that women in these places have been doing this work for such a long time. So in a way, I mean, as much as it's a book about GBV, and it's a book about sexual abuse, it's also very much a book about a global South pushback against a kind of a white savior impulse in northern feminism, in which certain kinds of feminist women think it's necessary for them to stomp into contexts that they don't understand and tell us what we should be doing in order to resist the conditions that we face. And that lack of nuance can be really dangerous, and it can undermine the pre-existing agency of women in the global south. And of course, there's a whole other layer, particularly in the context of India, in which middle class and upper class and upper caste Indian feminists have more or less been accused of doing the same thing and of trying to white savior their way through the gendered crises of Dalit feminists who have a completely different life experience and a completely different level of income, class status, and education. So, in a way, it's a book that is trying to not democratize feminism, but rather emphasize the kind of consistent appearance of feminism at all levels of society and in all different contexts, and to show that, Me Too, despite its self-aggrandizing nature at some times, was not actually the answer to these problems, that the problems that we face in places like India and South Africa are very much older. And I mean, we are talking about two countries that are known for being so-called rape capitals of the world. Another impulse behind doing this kind of work, I think, is to go, yes, these are places with incredibly high rates of GBV and rates of rape. And it's incredibly important that we acknowledge that and that we ask what has gone wrong with masculinity in these places that is allowing this kind of behavior to take place without taboos. But it's also incredibly important that we are able to acknowledge, okay, so this is what women in these places are doing to deal with it without going, women in these places are powerless and women in these places need to be saved, because that kind of narrative just adds to the original problem that we're facing.
Misinformation and out of context. And that takes me to the point of media and how important it is to get the right narratives coming across, or have a diversity of narratives so people don't continuously have one version of the truth. There was a 2020 study posted by the International Women's Media Foundation, which, thinking of the African perspective in particular, it showed that in Nigeria and South Africa, 80% of news protagonists were women. So 50% of the population doesn't get a voice. Then in the Global Media Monitoring Project for 2020, it showed that globally, less than 8% of news stories featured women as a central focus and gave less than 30% of screen time to female professionals compared to men. And interestingly, in this, overbearingly portrayed women as kind of like the caregivers and home takers. So we make up half the world's population, but we don't receive equivalent space for our voices and stories. What are some of your thoughts?
I mean, this is the same argument that I make all the time around victims of violence in South Africa and the issue of race, that violence that happens to white people is seen to be exceptional and more important, and therefore it gets more coverage than identical, more or less, things that happen to other people who are classified in racially different ways. The kind of consistent white supremacist patriarchal nature of modern society is as evident in media systems as it is anywhere else. And yes, I agree with you. Well, I don't necessarily think, things like quota systems are the answer, or counting numbers. There needs to be some sort of reckoning amongst the people who make the news. There needs to be some sort of level of education amongst the people who make the news. If you are only featuring the same sorts of people all the time, you are assuming people are only interested in the same sorts of stories all the time. You're not a good newsmaker. You need to think more deeply. I mean, one comparator with this is Hollywood, which has been saying for decades that films featuring women as their central protagonists don't sell. But then every now and then, a film featuring a woman as a central protagonist explodes and sells more than anyone's sold in a year. And everyone there is so surprised.
Look at Barbie.
Exactly. Barbie is the quintessential example. But I mean, it happens with other things like Moonlight, which won a Best Picture Oscar. No one was expecting a film about a gay black man to do anything. And yet it did, because media audiences actually oftentimes have more of an interest in plurality than media makers are willing to acknowledge. And a lot of media makers, I think, play it safe. They do things that they know that they are comfortable with. They don't try and push their boundaries in any particular way. And so the same stories get told over and over again. And of course, if we only ever hear from one kind of person, we will only ever think that there's one kind of thing going on in the world. I mean, we know this from decades of work on queer representation, that when young queer people see themselves on TV, suicide rates go down. Because suddenly you don't feel as strange or as ashamed. It really does make a difference what sorts of people get featured in the media, but it's a very, very difficult thing to shift.
And I can't help but think and wonder if it isn't also because of the composition of the decision makers, be it in the newsroom, be it in the C-suite, who to this day, it's still largely white men.
I mean, yes, on paper, I think that that is significant, but I'm also wary of assuming that having more women in positions of influence would necessarily benefit women. And, I like to call this the Margaret Thatcher effect. We see this in the North all the time. Every time a woman rises to a position of power, everyone is so happy. From Margaret Thatcher to Kamala Harris, it doesn't really matter who it is. It's like, oh, great. Okay. So the person signing off on the drone strikes that are murdering brown and black women in the global south is now a female. Great. Girl boss. Hashtag brilliant. Amazing. Women are not necessarily much better at representing or fighting for women. We have seen this repeatedly, that there is a way in which women who manage to fight their way to the tops of our current sorts of institutions often end up behaving more manly than the men.
Why?
Well, to put it bluntly, I think the problem is the systems, not the people. I think the problem is capitalism, right? I think the problem is that we live in a hugely exploitative global capitalist system that is based on violent patriarchy and exploitative white supremacy, and we have been for centuries now. So, in order to progress within that system, whether you are white or not, whether you are male or not, you need to be able to think and act like a white man in order to get ahead, in order to be accepted in those spaces. You must, to some extent, be able to perform the kinds of power games and power dynamics that white masculinity has been conditioned, trained, and specialized into since the dawn of the colonial era. So just putting a woman on top of a pyramid, but leaving the pyramid exactly the same, is actually going to make no difference at all. It's not going to lead to any substantive change. The systems themselves need to be radically, radically overhauled. I wish I had an answer for how you do that, but I really don't.
Such an interesting point of view because it's been a topic that has been bothering me a lot. Why things don't change. And yes, you're right. We have these celebrations of where women have made it or where they've been put into positions. But despite them being in those roles, things don't change. And you've kind of hit the nail on the head with the system has to change. It doesn't matter who's in the role. If the system doesn't change, they have to conform to the system.
I mean, once again, to bring it back to a comparison with race, because that does just tend to be where my brain goes. In the context of South Africa, right, we've had massive social changes, huge demographic changes in who has wealth. But we still have a system where some people have wealth. So after 1994, where we had this kind of two-tier country of white elites and black poverty, that shifted to the extent that we now have multiracial elites and black poverty and a tiny smidgen of white poverty. But most people's lives have not fundamentally, substantively changed in the sense that they have real social mobility, even though the government is made up of black South Africans and the elites are full of black South Africans, and black South Africans have done incredibly well. And that is because the system itself has not changed. The system itself, in which we emphasize profit over collectivity and personal gain over social improvement and social mobility, that hasn't shifted. All that's happened is that the people filling those roles have changed. And that is not a way to implement any real and substantive social change. It doesn't matter how many female CEOs we have, if the majority of women still remain at risk of gender-based violence or domestic violence or a pay gap or terrible maternity benefits or maternal mortality rates, any of these things that affect women at large, if those things don't change, then, all we're doing by putting powerful women into higher positions is, making life better for those particular women and the people who surround them. There's not going to be any substantive trickle down because there never is.
So the big question, how do we get systems to change?
Peaceful revolution? I don't know. I get asked this all the time because, I kind of spout off with these fairly radical ideas about how society as a whole needs to be completely upended. And I don't have the answer to that. I know that I have colleagues who advocate the kind of Fanonian cleansing power of violence and how violence is the only way to overthrow a system. I do not subscribe to that at all because, the problem with using violence as a tool for social change is that the majority of that violence does not impact the people you want it to impact. It impacts poor women and children. It's the same people on the bottom all the time. So that's really, really not an answer. We need some much more radical thinking than simply advocating for 19th century forms of revolution. But I don't know what that would look like. One thing that I do think would be incredibly useful in our societies at large would be if we were more engaged as citizens. I think, you know, democracy as a system obviously has its benefits, but what it fundamentally involves is hiring someone and outsourcing all our decisions to them, which means placing an enormous amount of trust in them. And it also gives 95% of us the right to go, oh, well, I voted, I don't have to do anything else. An engaged citizenry is a really good model for social change. Small, I'm not suggesting, you know, wipe out governments and let's all go live in the hills with our survivalist arms, but smaller, localized bodies that impact on localized communities in specific ways and deal with things that are really important to them. Those kinds of initiatives can actually create social change in a small way. And we saw a lot of this during the pandemic when people were self-organizing in really, really helpful ways and trying to do things that supported those around them who they had ignored previously, despite the fact that it took work that we wouldn't on a daily basis be willing to do. We wouldn't be willing to put that kind of work into our communities. But that didn't last very long. And then everyone went back behind their high walls after they got their vaccines and started calling their security companies again. The walls need to come down for us to really build anything collectively.
Great insights. I really wish that we had more time to explore these further. It's fantastic topics, and I look forward to reading some more of your work. Prof. Felkoff, we're coming to the end of the show now, and one of the
Thank you.
questions that I ask all my guests is about kind of their recipe to success or their recipe to life, because everyone takes a different view and we've all got different experiences. In your view, what have been some of the key drivers to your success?
Massive insecurity and imposter syndrome, but that's what every female academic says. I think in a lot of ways I'm animated by rage. I think I have I don't know if it's just character or if it's something to do with my childhood, or I have a very highly developed sense of injustice, and I get very, very upset when I feel like things are unfair. And it's a child's reaction almost. You know, the way that children will look at things that aren't fair and go, but that's not right. It shouldn't be that way. And I feel as though that's been driving me since I was old enough to figure out that there was something really weird about growing up as a white person at the end of apartheid. And it took me a long time to understand what it was. But I think those early experiences of the kind of fundamental daily injustices that we were living with and that I was benefiting from and that I still benefit from affected me really deeply on an emotional level and have pushed me to do a lot of the stuff that I've done since then, that I feel like things are unfair and it shouldn't be this way.
You mentioned at the beginning of the conversation some of the aspects that shaped your identity, and with your PhD topic being where did all the Satanists go? So I'd like to ask you about some of the pivotal moments in your life growing up.
I mean, let's not get too personal, but my parents divorced when I was very young, and my mom did. You know, I'm still close to both of my parents. They're very much involved in my life, but my mom did until she met her second husband, who she's still married to. She did raise us as a single mother. And that was a significant thing. She worked, and it wasn't that common among middle class white women in Joburg in the 1980s to have full time jobs and leave your kids at home and them to not have a dad around. And it was quite strange. And I know that as a child, I watched her struggle, but I also watched her insist on being independent and fight for her independence and struggle for it. It was difficult, and it was emotional work for her because the way that she had chosen to live after her divorce was seen as not really appropriate. And, you know, there was an assumption that she needed to go off and find another man immediately because you can't possibly be on your own and your kids need a dad. And until she met my stepdad, she did a damn good job of keeping it together. And I think that was something that was quite significant for me, was seeing that, you know, my mom's not exactly a wild radical. But just watching someone go, okay, I'm going to go a little bit against the grain here, and I'm going to try and do the thing that I think is right for me as a woman in a fairly conservative society because I know that what I'm being told to do isn't really going to work for me at this moment. I think that was quite something that was quite formative.
Thinking about the 1980s for white women at that time, you still had to get permission from your husband to do half the things that you wanted to do. Couldn't buy a house, couldn't
No.
open a bank account. It's amazing what women have had to go through.
Yeah, my mum went straight from her dad's house to her husband's house. The first time she ever lived alone was after her divorce, and suddenly she was on her own with two kids. I mean, I had my first child at 45 when I was already an associate professor, and I had an income and a great partner, and I'd had loads of fun, and I'd traveled, I'd done all this different stuff. My mother was having children so much earlier than me, and never had any financial independence until she had to suddenly figure it out. And the differences, just in one generation, the differences in our lives and our life choices have been astonishing. And my family has always been broadly like befuddled, but broadly supportive of the choices that I've made. And I think that's significant as well, that I grew up in a scenario in which I was told, no, you do you. You go and fight, you follow this thing. I spent a lot of my adolescence and early 20s assuming I was going to be an actress. I actually went to theatre school at the University of Cape Town before I ended up studying English. And even though, I'm Jewish families very emphasize academic achievement, it was a bit of an issue for some people that I was doing this kind of crazy thing instead of going off and being a lawyer, which is what intelligent girls are supposed to do. But no one ever stopped me. No one ever stopped me. They weren't entirely sure what was happening, but they said, you go and you try, and we'll be here for you. And that, I think, is really unusual. And that's also a cultural difference that I experience with a lot of my Black female friends whose families are very traditional, who have had to fight really hard to be allowed to take the career paths that they take and to be allowed to postpone marriage and children in the ways that they have in order to build themselves up before they become mothers. And, I'm enormously grateful for that. I really am. I think it's significant and maybe something we don't pay enough attention to as certain types of women in the 21st century who are used to a degree of social freedom.
And the ability of not having to conform to stereotypes and what society expects from you. And I love that expression of you being allowed to do you.
Yeah. And there's always going to be a little bit of disapproval from somebody if you decide to do you. Someone is always going to tell you that you're doing you wrong and that you're wasting your potential or that your eyes are too big. You have too much ambition and you shouldn't try for this because it's not appropriate. But it's a lot easier now than it used to be to go, okay, well, that's what you think. That's not what I think. Goodbye. And just go and do it anyway.
Prof. Falkoff, I've really enjoyed our conversation. As we wrap up the show, please can you share a few words of inspiration, motivation that you'd like to convey to women living on the continent?
That's a hard question. I'm not very good at being inspiring and motivational because I'm usually quite cynical about everything. But I think if there's one thing I would say, it's that change doesn't happen unless we make it happen. There is no sense in sitting and waiting for the big structures that we live within to make our lives better. Governments won't make our lives better, institutions won't make our lives better. The real change comes from individual people who are bold enough, wise enough, brave enough, and energetic enough to go out and make things better in one way or another. Tiny changes have huge knock-on effects, and we see that up and down this continent all the time. We see inspirational people up and down this continent all the time actually having impacts on how we live. So I guess, my motivation or my inspiration would be don't wait for someone to do it for you.
Great message. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, and today we have been talking to Professor Nikki Falkoff, who is a cultural studies scholar based in the Media Studies Department at the University of the Witwatersrand.